magic power, so make a wish, and I'll let it come true for you.
It's been 5 years since Judd Apatow first introduced us and knocked up to the married couple, Pete and Debbie, played by Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann. They're back again in This Is 40, a very honest and funny portrait of love, sex, marriage, and parenthood over the course of three tumultuous weeks. In case you haven't been paying attention, Judd Apatow's previous hit films include The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Funny People. He's also produced the hits Bridesmaids and Get Him to the Greek and the popular HBO series Girls. This Is 40 opens this Friday at theaters around town. I'm excited to welcome Judd Apatow to our show today. Hello.
It is great to be here.
When did you know that you had more to say about Pete and Debbie and that they needed a movie of their own?
I just started thinking about my house and how weird it was, how many funny fights we were getting into, how aggressive my kids were with each other. They're 15 and 10 now, and their sibling rivalry was just out of control. And they're so ingenious about hurting each other and hurting each other's feelings, that I thought it would be pretty interesting to try to capture that on film. You never see real kids acting with a real parent in a movie. So I thought, wow, I bet something special could happen there. And also, I was in my early 40s, and I'm a real clock watcher. I'm very aware of how long the kids will be in the house before they go to college. And, I'm in my 30s, now in my 40s. I guess my body's slowly going to start falling apart. And how do I feel about that? And so I have bad obsessions with time. I mean, I've made four movies, and two of them have the number 40 in the title. So clearly, I have some problems.
Well, the kids playing the kids here are your kids. So was this just an extension of the things they did at home?
Some of it is very specific to things that my kids were doing. My daughter watched the entire series of Lost in 6 weeks, and she was crying and happy and going through all these intense emotions. And Leslie and I were really freaked out. Like, are we bad parents for letting her do this? She was on episode 85, and she kept saying, I only have 25 left. So we thought, I guess we got to let her go through it. And then I realized, I should write about this, because with all of the new technology, we have so many new issues to deal with kids that we never had to deal with before. And we're scared that we're going to make the wrong decision. Am I going to ruin my kid because she's going to watch Breaking Bad in 2 weeks? Or is that a great thing that will enlighten her and teach her about art and writing?
Well, the whole business of her watching all those episodes of Lost is a running joke in this film. Mm-hmm. Did she feel you were making fun of her? Because you are.
I am making fun of her. I'm making fun of myself. And I find that most people act ridiculous most of the time, and by sharing our ridiculousness, we all can feel a little better that we're not alone in our struggle. So I did sit with them and say, hey, this is what I do for a living. You want to know what I really do? I share my life and my feelings with other people so that they can feel less alone in what they're going through. And it is a gift that you give people. You try to make them laugh, but you're also connecting with people. Like, look, that thing you think no one does, we all do it.
Well, Pete is unlike you. Yes. In many ways, mm-hmm. But the obvious question comes up, how autobiographical is this film?
It's about a third. I keep saying it's a third.
Based on little things that have happened.
Yeah, a third based on us, a third based on things we've made up or observed. And then the really embarrassing stuff is directly from Paul Rudd's life.
Because you've worked with him before, in a number of films.
Yes.
So by now you kind of know his quirks and you draw upon them.
Well, I also will say to Paul, when I first start writing, what's happening with you and your wife? How are you getting along? What are you fighting about? And I'll call his wife, we'll have dinner with her, and she'll make lists of things that bug her about him. And we do it all the time.
And the same thing happened with your wife? You must have passed the script by her.
Yes, we'll have
before you actually asked her to appear in it.
Well, I mean, it's kind of written with her. I mean, I come up with the idea and I start telling her aspects of it that I need her approval for. But then she starts pitching me all these ideas about annoying things I do, things she's struggling with. There's a big sequence where she goes to a nightclub with Megan Fox and gets hit on by a hockey team. And she talked to me a lot about how good it feels to, you know, to still have people interested in you and to feel attractive. And so we wrote a big sequence about that.
Even though you're 40, because she's going through a major crisis about turning 40.
That's right. She, you know, she's, you know, in the movie, you know, trying not to deal with it. She keeps telling everyone that she's 38 because she wants two more years. So that's, you know, that's, you know, something I think most people go through.
Your name has often been associated with somewhat raunchy comedies. Do you feel that's okay? And do you think that applies to this film as well?
I love truth, and I think that we're gross some of the time, and so I'm not afraid to show that. I think we're sexual some of the time. We're inappropriate some of the time. And, you know, I always think it's funny when people try to be mature, because I don't think people are mature. I think people pretend to be mature, but we're all a mess, and we're all children forever. I went and visited my grandmother at a nursing home where she lives, and she's 90. And she'll say, we can't eat at that table because they're a clique. They don't let me eat with them. And it's just high school forever.
Well, if you were single and some you met a woman who said, I'm very mature, wouldn't that scare you off?
Exactly.
You want somebody who...
I want someone who's a mess like me. I think you find your level. And, you know, you keep thinking, oh, I'm going to find a totally sane person. But you're going to find someone who's exactly as crazy as you are.
But couldn't we also say that all of your work has been somehow about relationships dating back to the Larry Sanders Show, where you were a writer, producer? That was about an office situation and a television show that involved a somewhat dysfunctional family.
About the Larry Sanders Show. Yeah, I mean, Gary always said, you know, the Larry Sanders Show is about people who love each other, but show business gets in the way. You know, their egos, their hunger to be more successful or more famous. And I feel that's true of most movies, that a lot of them, you know, they're about people who love each other, but something in life gets in the way. Like obstacles to really connecting and being kind. And a lot of times those obstacles are just your own wounds or your own, what you're anxious about.
And you're obviously drawing upon real experiences, because anyone who has worked on a talk show found that show to be hilarious. Most of those things occur to us, other than me sleeping with all of the attractive guests.
Yes. Well, we know that's
Larry
true.
Larry did that.
Yes. I think that, you know, a lot of those ideas happen as a result of Gary being a guest host at The Tonight Show. So he was around that. And when we did the Larry Sanders Show, you know, Gary was being offered all the talk shows. So he was doing a show making fun of what was happening while being offered the real shows. And there was a moment where he had to decide whether or not to satirize talk shows or become a talk show host. And he decided that he would rather make the show than host a show.
My guest is Judd Apatow, who is the writer, director, and producer of This Is 40, which opens Friday in theaters around town. Some of the subject matter here struck me as what I might expect from an independent film rather than something from a big studio. Has your success allowed you to go against the conventional studio wisdom?
The studio wisdom is whatever makes money, we like. So if you can make a movie and have it be successful in the box office, they give you more freedom next time. That's just how
it works.
But
there are no explosions here?
We have no explosions. We just have people talking, people being funny. And it's really, you know, about a family trying to figure out how to make it work. And, you know, as things come apart, it's hopefully very funny to people. And I think there's something happening in Hollywood where they want movies to work all around the world. So it's easier to make a movie that will play well in China if you blow some stuff up or make it visually dazzling. And I love those movies myself. But I love human dramas and human comedies, and you know, I want people to make movies like The Graduate and Harold and Maude. So I'm trying to stay in that tradition, and I hope you know, my movie does well, which will encourage them to make more movies like this.
Well, how did the script evolve? You talked about drawing upon your own experiences and Paul Rudd's experiences, but you still had to wind up developing a plot and moving from here to there and bringing in all those other characters and those other stories.
Well, how do I create this kind of story?
Where did it start?
Well, it started because I was writing Knocked Up, and I thought, I want to have Katherine Heigl's character have a sister who's married and having a difficult marriage, so that when they get suddenly pregnant after a first date, they're very, very scared, and seeing their future makes them more scared. So Leslie and Paul were the ghosts of Christmas future. And in a way, in my head, both couples were the same couple. There were two ages of Leslie and myself.
They're first the couple that has high hopes for the future,
yes.
And then they are the reality of the future.
Exactly. And so after Knocked Up, people would always quote it to me, and people were really intrigued by Leslie and Paul's characters, and there was a scene where Leslie couldn't get into a nightclub, and she's like, screams and curses out the doorman and is screaming, "Doorman, doorman, doorman!" But it was really about how she felt bad that she was getting older, and it wasn't kind of normal to be going to a nightclub with 21-year-old kids.
Hmm.
So I felt like I didn't fully explore relationships at that age in Knocked Up, and there was so much more to say that could be really funny.
And there are all these hilariously funny, petty squabbles that people don't want others to see. But, and at the time, really feel very powerful. Only later, when we think back, we think, what the heck was that all about?
Well, that's true. I mean, I kind of feel like, what's fun about the movie is that, you see how much they love each other, but when they fight, they go off the rails and they say very hurtful things, and you can see what they're hiding and what their insecurities are. And so as soon as they get into a fight, it's like they've been holding back all of these insecure thoughts, and they all come out at once.
Although Debbie digs in and Pete detaches.
Yes. I think that, some women are more emotionally connected than men, and we tend to just want to numb out and shut down or put on the TV and not just think about all of our feelings. And it's hard for us. A lot of times women, I think, are forcing men to be in the moment and to connect.
Well, part of the midlife crisis in this case is that Pete is dissatisfied a lot with where his life has wound up. She is slightly less so, but she's also having problems. They're facing economic problems, and both of them are turning 40.
Yes, it's about a lot of issues. They have economic problems. He has a record company that puts out his favorite bands from the 70s and 80s, and it's not working. And she has a store, and they think their employees are stealing from them. So in addition to turning 40, they're having these financial issues. And Paul Rudd's dad, played by Albert Brooks, he's kind of broke, and he borrows money all the time. So if they go under, the dad goes under as well. So all of their stresses are kind of landing at the same time. And I kind of feel like people spin a lot of plates. You have your can I be a good husband plate, and can I be a good dad, and can I help the kids with their schoolwork, and can I do well at my work, and how do I deal with my extended family and media and technology and the culture. And every once in a while, all the plates crash because you just don't have enough hours in the day to do it all correctly. And this is a movie's a funny version of what happens when it all melts.
And I want to get back to that father-son relationship and the father-daughter relationship with John Lithgow and the wife here. It is interesting that all of this takes place in the middle of a relationship where people begin to feel insecure about it, even though they love each other very much.
That's true. I think it's a little bit of a flashpoint when you've been married about 15 to 20 years where you realize, I guess this is it. You're my wife. This is my family. I mean, either I'm going to start a new one now or we're fully committed. And, everything is a combination of good and bad. And if you spend a lot of time with anybody, they're going to drive you crazy and point out what's wrong with you. And that's irritating when someone tells you what's wrong with you. I'd rather keep it focused on what's wrong with the other person. So it's challenging. And I think you look at your life in your 40s and you think, this is how it went. And how can I make it work better?
Judd Apatow's This Is 40, which he wrote, directed, and produced, opens this Friday in theaters around town. We will continue our conversation after we take a break for the latest news. Stay with us.
1, 2, 3, 4. We used to be friends, now we just fight. Oh, what do you like?
Graham Parker from the soundtrack of a new film called This Is 40. Judd Apatow is our guest. He wrote, directed, and produced it. It opens in theaters around town. And how did Graham Parker get involved in all of this? As someone that Paul Rudd's label is trying to make a go with.
I thought it would be fun to show the struggles that Paul Rudd's character is having as a owner of a small record label. So he puts out all the people that he loves, like Paul Westerberg and Frank Black and all the kind of the great indie rock gods. And you know, there are so many of these people, they continue to put out amazing records, but they're not selling as many records as Rihanna. And I wish they should. They deserve to. But
there's a joke in there. I think he sold 700 CDs.
Well, Graham Parker's not selling a lot of CDs. And I think the music business is a little bit in disarray as a result of digital downloading and that transition not working very well. So I needed a band that would agree to be in the movie as representing an artist who's not selling a lot of records. Graham Parker is one of the great rock legends who, you know, he came up before Elvis Costello and The Clash at about 1974. And he broke up his band, Graham Parker and the Rumor, in 1980, and has put out a lot of records since then that are excellent. So I heard... I heard that Graham was interested in working with me through his website. So I took him out to lunch and I told him a little bit about the movie.
But he's a butt of a joke here.
Yeah, I told
him. Was he at all concerned that the plot involves the fact that no one buys his records anymore?
Well, I told him that and he said to me, yeah, I'm not selling a lot of records. And he laughed about it. And in fact, there was a documentary I watched about him. And in it, he said, you know, a lot of people pay their dues in the beginning of their career. I'm paying mine now. So he's really funny and self-effacing, but also very confident as an artist because his albums are great. And there's so many people who continue to put out great records that don't sell. So he was game to do a Larry Sanders Show type treatment on his career and the music industry. And so he's really funny and goofs on himself hard in the movie because there's a lot of jokes about older rock stars and older rock stars not looking good and not selling a lot of records. But what's happened is, since the movie started, he went on tour with Graham Parker and The Rumor.
The Rumor got together. This was an opportunity for them to reunite.
They got together. They made a record. The record's selling really well. And they did a sold-out tour across America. And they're going to do more dates next year. So he made fun of himself as if his career is not going well. And that got him so much publicity that his career is going well. So it worked perfectly.
You also had a bunch of other artists do the soundtrack. Did you start approaching them before you began shooting? Because you can't always just get Fiona Apple, Nora Jones, Lindsay Buckingham, and Ryan Adams to contribute to a soundtrack.
I did. I'm usually afraid to ask people to write original songs for a movie because I think, what if they give me a terrible song and I have to, you know, tell someone I worship that I hate their song? But I said, I'm just going to go for it this time. And so Lindsay Buckingham came over to my house one day with a guitar, and we talked about the types of songs we would need and kicked around some titles. And then he went off and he wrote 5 songs. We recorded 3 of them that are on the soundtrack. And the same with Nora Jones. She wrote a beautiful song that we use as score in a lot of the movie. And Wilco recorded a remake of an old song of theirs, but a kind of a bluegrass treatment of an old song called I Got You. And we had this guy who is a genius named John Bryan, who did the score to Magnolia, and he produced one of Kanye West's albums and a lot of Fiona's albums. And what he did is he recorded with all of these artists, but he had them all play on each other's songs. And he also had the Punch Brothers play on all of the songs. So even though there's a, you know, there's a Lindsey Buckingham song, Norah Jones sings backup on it, and Lindsey Buckingham plays guitar on her song. So he did this really fascinating tapestry with all these people in a way no one ever does it.
And that makes for a good soundtrack album as well.
It's a, yeah, the record is great, available on iTunes.
I'm assuming that you also see making a film as an opportunity to work with some people you want to work with, like Albert Brooks, who is one of the funniest people in the world.
That's true.
And here he plays the very annoying father of Paul Rudd in a, as you mentioned earlier, kind of parent-child role reversal relationship. He keeps on hitting up his son for money. He's like the child of his son. Is that based on somebody you knew?
You know, it's based on an enormous amount of relationships that we've seen over the years. I think that, you know, people are living for a really long time. There's a lot of people who didn't assume they had to save that much for their retirement. And I think that a lot of people are having economic problems and suddenly they have to turn to their children for help. And it creates a new, very sensitive dynamic where you can become the parent to one of your parents. And it's also very funny because it's Albert Brooks. Mm. And what complicates it is his wife really wanted a child. So at 60, they did in vitro, and he didn't think it would work. But his wife wound up having triplets. So he's having financial problems, and he has many children. And he's so funny in this very, very difficult situation.
And the other father-in-law, John Lithgow, playing Leslie's emotionally remote father.
Yes, John Lithgow is one of my favorite actors of all time. He's in my favorite movie, Terms of Endearment. I only realized after we shot the movie that I had stolen the Oscar-nominated Best Supporting Actor from two James Brooks movies, Albert Brooks for Broadcast News and John Lithgow for Terms of Endearment. You know, I've been reticent to work with a lot of my heroes because I would never want to put them in a bad movie because I respect them so much. But I did it this time, and they were so helpful. I mean, they have just so much experience to bring to the table. And in rehearsals, when you talk through the character and the story, people like John Lithgow help you find new depths that you didn't even know were there.
Do you encourage them to improvise?
What we do is we go into rehearsal and we read all the scenes, and then we have long conversations about what it means and what the tone should be. And then I'll rewrite and we'll improvise. And then I go off and I do a major revision based on these work sessions. So by the time we get to the set, the script is pretty locked. But what I tend to do is remember all these funny things they said in rehearsals, and I make them record all of those when we shoot.
I assume that's what happened with Melissa McCarthy, who's outrageous as the parent of one of Maude's classmates, you know, the daughter's classmates. Although the outtake of the scene where she explodes in the principal's office is something that people who leave while the credits are rolling will regret having missed.
She's so funny. Melissa McCarthy I met when we did Bridesmaids, and she's on that show Mike and Molly. She's in, you know, just a few scenes in the movie, and they're the funniest scenes in the movie because she is truly, you know, as funny as anyone I've ever met, and she plays a disgruntled parent who gets into a really big argument with Leslie and Paul about how their kids are communicating on the internet.
You couldn't use that scene because Leslie and Paul are cracking up during the scene?
Well, if what you notice is that I shot that scene with three cameras, so when Melissa's doing her lines, you see her on a single. But then when you show the wide shot, you see that the whole time Melissa's doing her lines, Leslie and Paul are trying not to laugh, and their faces are there's snot coming out, there's tears. And so it's actually not ruining her single. They're just ruining the wide shot.
Now, you also have Megan Fox playing Desi, a hyper-productive salesperson who works in Debbie's store. This is a far cry from the Transformers.
It's very different. I mean, I always feel bad for people who have so much more to offer. I mean, she's a beautiful, beautiful woman, and she's great in the Transformers movies, in these action movies, but she's also hilarious and a very sympathetic actress. She's really, really wickedly funny and was as funny as anyone else when we got into our rehearsals and tried to conceive of these characters. So I'm excited that people have responded to her in such a big way.
You also used some other things you knew, obviously. Leslie dancing. She's yes. bad and funny about it at the same time.
And she's trying to be a good dancer. It's just not working out.
Use her in the 40-year virgin as well.
Yes, that's right. Anytime Leslie tries to dance, she really thinks she's good in life. And then she's like, why is this funny? And I'm like, don't worry about it.
Now, can you tell me about the selection of books you chose for the Wall Street Journal that would okay. represent you? My ideal bookshelf. Some of those books, I'm not surprised by. Albert Brooks's novel 2030 is on the list. Steve Martin's Born Standing Up. I'm assuming that they had an influence. But we also have Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life. Saul Bellow Sees the Day.
That's right.
Not surprised to see Lenny Bruce there.
Yes, this is a project that it's a book called My Ideal Bookshelf. And what they did is they asked all sorts of people what their ideal bookshelf would look like. So, you know, they said, you know, give us a dozen books, and they do a beautiful painting of what that bookshelf would look like. And so I just listed some of my favorite books. You know, Saul Bellow is obviously one of the great novelists of all time, and it's very dark and also darkly funny. Tobias Wolff is someone whose short stories and memoirs I've enjoyed for a very long time. I tend to like people who have humor. You know, Tobias Wolff is also very funny in addition to being very dramatic.
Well, hadn't you originally wanted to be a stand-up?
I did. I wanted to be a stand-up. I only wanted to be Jerry Seinfeld or Jay Leno when I was a kid. And I did stand-up for 7 years and slowly realized that my ideas worked better when written into dramatic situations. You know, my comedic thoughts were best played out as theater.
Or television, because you worked a lot on television, yeah. including the Ben Stiller show, Larry Sanders show we mentioned. So how did you, or when did you, what led to the jump into directing your first feature film, The 40-Year-Old Virgin?
You know, I never pursued directing. When I went to college, I studied screenwriting, and we did some directing classes, and I always felt like I wasn't very good. I went to school with a lot of very talented people who were so much better than me. It scared me off of directing in a lot of ways. And then I...
In what way? Directing as directing actors or moving the camera so that you tell the story in the best way possible?
Yeah, I think like the physical part of it and the visual part of it. One of the people I went to school with, his name was Matt Reeves, who created Felicity. And he just did that movie, the American version of Let the Right One In. He's just... really, really was brilliant during college. Like when he would show the film he made, it was so remarkable that it made me embarrassed to show mine. And then I was just always afraid the eye lines wouldn't match. I just thought like literally it wouldn't make sense. Not that it would be bad, that it like fit, like it wouldn't even, it would look like some insane Ed Wood movie. and I never pursued it. And then when I was producing at the Larry Sanders Show, Shanling said to me, oh, you have to direct an episode before we stop doing this. And he made me do it. And it wasn't something I asked to do. I was very scared. And he helped me. And then I said, okay, I should learn how to do this. So when we did Freaks and Geeks, I directed 4 episodes. And that's when I really learned how to do it.
And then you had to convince people to give you money to make The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
That's right. I think after Anchorman was a success, the studio realized that making movies at a reasonable budget with really funny people who were not super expensive because they weren't stars yet was a good business model. And Steve Carell had this idea for The 40-Year-Old Virgin, so we wrote it together and did it, you know, inexpensively. And we still make our movies pretty inexpensively. And because that did well, they were like, well, what other ideas do you have? Well, we got Superbad, we got Pineapple Express, and then suddenly the train was moving.
Because when you make a film that's not all that expensive and it makes millions and millions of dollars, it makes a lot of people happy.
You know, they are very happy and they trust you more when something succeeds. You know, they think, well, maybe they know what they're doing. And then they let you be more creative because you can't predict what will make people laugh or what movie people will like. It's just it's all a guessing game, and so they really bet on talent once you've proven yourself.
Are you already working on your next project?
Well, I'm a producer on the sequel to Anchorman, so that's going to shoot in March, and then I'm producing the we're about to shoot the third season of Girls. The second season of
Girls.
What
does producing mean in those circumstances?
Well, with Girls, what it means is I'm the guy who's looking for trouble. I'll write a little bit with Lena. I'll write an episode or two. I'm you know, working with her and Jenny Connor, the other showrunner, to arc out the season and to be part of the writing process. And I'm also involved with just the basic mechanics of, you know, getting all the, you know, making sure we have enough money to make the show and the marketing and, you know, all the other details that most people don't realize that we have to spend 8 hours debating what should be on the poster.
You have included your kids in a couple of your movies. Are you worried that they'll become show business kids? Do you want them to go in show business?
You know, what's funny is I didn't put my kids in the movie because I want them to be actresses. I put them in the movie because I thought it would make the movie better. I never thought they would be really great, and now I would have to field offers for them. I wasn't trying to launch anything. So now, you know, if Peter Jackson calls, I will hang up on him.
Well, they could be in the third Hobbit film.
They could be they could be little troll creatures.
You're from Syosset. Welcome home.
That's right. I am. I'm from Long Island. Syosset and Woodbury. I lived in the gates at Woodbury, and I was there till I went to college. I had an amazing childhood. As I look back, it really was an idyllic place to grow up.
Judd Apatow's latest film is This Is 40. It opens this Friday at theaters all around town. You can also see the third season of the popular HBO series Girls, which he produces. And I'm assuming there's another film this time, probably starring Megan Fox, because
that's
you
right.
Like to take the minor characters and give them their own films.
I would go to that movie.
Thanks so much for being with us.
It was great to be here.
I don't remember where we were and young. Oh, that's faded in the memory. I feel like somebody I don't know. Are we really who we used to be? Am I really who I was? Oh, the lights draw you in, and the dark will take you down, and the night